Howard? Bobby?
Michelle's here. Howard will be on any minute now.
Thanks.
Morning.
Howard.
Morning, Howard.
Mike, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Hi, Michelle. How you doing, Mike?
Good. I got your emails yesterday. I'm sorry I had to under the weather. So,
I'm sorry to hear that.
I'll get working on it, and I'll get it back to you and Don.
Okay. I thought it was a good sign, by the way.
Your optimism, but you know, I was hoping that loss was there, to be honest.
I'm sorry you cut out.
I was hoping that Oscar's boss would be part of the meeting.
We don't know whether he will or won't.
That's true. I don't think Oscar has the capacity.
I think his ability to comprehend is pretty limited.
I agree. But people probably say the same thing about me.
See the Terps last night?
I was catching the scores on and off. Like I said, I was under the weather, so I was dozing in and out. I thought that, listen, a win's a win. I'm not feeling well.
Yeah. Michelle, how are you doing this morning?
Good, how are you?
Good. We finally got a pretty nice day outside today.
Actually, have
I know, I'm looking forward to it.
And we're going to get started in a minute. Thank you. Okay, it's 9:02 on my clock. We're going to get started. Michelle, can you mute the line, please? All right. Good morning to everybody. It is the last telebrief in January, hard to believe, but 2017 is upon us. And as usual, a bunch of stuff to talk about. The first thing that I wanted to mention is something that may be a trendsetter, I'm not sure, but this happened on Monday when the mayor of Philadelphia, Jim Kenney, signed a new law into effect that will prevent Philadelphia employers from inquiring or asking job applicants to disclose their prior salary history. Now, I know that we've talked about this before in some telebriefs. Actually, Philadelphia becomes the first big city to enact this legislation. As you know, we talked about this before, and Massachusetts passed a similar act back in August of 2016, which will go into effect in July 2018. And similar bills we know have been introduced in New Jersey and in New York City. But this is the first bill that's been passed in a United States city, and it was passed by Philadelphia's City Council in December and will go into effect 120 days from the date that the mayor, Mayor Kenney, signed it on January the 23rd. It's an interesting statute, and you know, those of you out there, and even most of my clients, most of the time ask for prior salary history in order to get some idea about what the appropriate new salary should be, whether it will be within your salary structure or the competitive marketplace. It's not without its opponents. In fact, the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce had a statement, and I'll briefly review it for you today. It says, with today's signing of a salary history bill, and that was on Monday, the city of Philadelphia continues its record of passing legislation that hurts job growth and business expansion. While this bill is supposedly an attempt to improve wage equity, there is in fact no evidence whatsoever that asking prospective employees about their current compensation contributes in any way to wage inequities. Unfortunately, the city government has rejected a proposal by the business community to discuss and enact a real wage equity ordinance. While the chamber is deeply committed to highly diverse and inclusive workplaces and will not tolerate wage inequity, we believe passage of this measure says Philadelphia is not open for business, says Chamber President and CEO Rob Wunderling. Philadelphia has a reputation around the country and world for having a high cost of doing business. With this bill, we have reinforced our unfortunate anti-business reputation of having a city government that tells companies how to run their business. So it was not without its opposition, and I assume it will not be without its opposition if it's introduced in any of the other big eastern cities as well. But it seems to be a trend. And of course, if that were enacted, you'd have to remove that question from your application. Now, it doesn't mean that you couldn't ask an applicant what that applicant's salary expectations were. That's a perfectly appropriate question to ask an applicant, what do you expect to earn? And obviously, for most jobs, you're going to have your own innate ideas, either because you've done research or you've had the job filled before, on what the applicable salary range would be. But nevertheless, and I've said this on prior telebriefs, it's useful to know what an applicant's prior salary history is for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, the extent to which you have an applicant who's moved up the salary scale in an impressive way is some indication of past job performance or past performance at an employer or prior employers. Secondly, I think that it's important to know what that salary history is so that you can gauge some reasonable expectation of what that person may be looking for in a salary increase, whether it's a 10% increase, 15% increase, etc. Nevertheless, under the Philadelphia statute and in states which have enacted it, you're not going to be permitted to ask it. An interesting question which is left open is whether or not you can receive this information, for instance, if you are considering an executive who is forwarded to you by a placement or search firm, and that search firm indicates to you what that person's salary is or salary history is. We don't know, as a prospective employer, whether the placement agency asked or whether that person volunteered, because under any statute, it's permissible for the applicant to volunteer salary history. It's just that you can't, as an employer, condition employment on revealing prior salary history or ask prior salary history. So this whole issue seems to be something that's gaining traction nationally, and I wouldn't be surprised if in Baltimore or other metropolitan area in Maryland or even at the state level, we have similar legislation that's introduced in the near future. So stay tuned about that. Speaking of state legislation, we know that, or you probably know, that there has been a bill introduced into the Maryland State Legislature, a sick leave bill that would mandate that companies with 15 or more employees provide 7 days of paid sick leave per year. And those with fewer than 15 employees would be required to provide unpaid days off. This, as you know, was introduced in the Maryland legislature last year, got a lot of news coverage. Ultimately, it did not pass. I think the prospects of something passing this session are greater than they were last year. One of the reasons is Governor Hogan has also proposed a form of paid leave that would require those employers with 50 or more employees to offer 5 days of paid time off. In order to be eligible, the employee would have to work an average of 30 hours per week. And under Hogan's plan, businesses that have fewer than 50 employees would and that provide 5 days of paid leave would qualify for a tax exemption, kind of an interesting concept. The following statement was promulgated and disseminated by the Maryland Chamber of Commerce in regard to the governor's prospective legislation. It says, "We applaud the governor for introducing legislation that reflects the many concerns that the business community has articulated regarding paid leave. While the chairs of the respective labor committees have included the business advocates in the process, we cannot support such a mandate due to the cost that will be imposed on employers. When it comes to improving our overall business climate, the legislature's most recent version of the mandatory paid leave bill is a step in the wrong direction." So this is going to be a bill and a conceptual piece of legislation that will be followed closely between now and mid-April when the session ends. And again, I think the prospects for some legislation to pass along these lines is greater even this year than it was last year. So stay tuned on this. I'm sure many of you out there already have sick leave provisions for your employees. The problem is that many of you may have a rolled up, personal leave policy, which would combine sick leave, personal leave, vacation into one sort of bucket of personal leave. Depending on how the legislation is drafted and enacted, if it is enacted, you may have to revisit it and then separate out as a bucket your sick leave provisions for employees. But again, I'll keep an eye on this and I will let you know what transpires with regard to this particular issue. on the federal side, interesting that President Trump has ordered executive departments and agencies to freeze all pending regulations until the administration or the appropriate people in the Trump administration can review them. This obviously would include the controversial DOL overtime rules, which were to go into effect, as you know, on December 1st, which were stymied by litigation in Texas, which is still pending, by the way. But it signals that many of the executive orders and regulations that were enacted and considered by the Obama administration may no longer have traction under the Trump administration. In fact, it's not unlikely that with regard to the DOL litigation, that under the Trump administration, the appeal of the injunction, which would prohibit enforcement of the DOL's overtime rules, could in fact be withdrawn by the Trump administration. We don't know what will happen. We do know that the hearing with regard to the new, newly nominated Secretary of Labor, Mr. Puzder, has been scheduled for February the 2nd, a couple weeks from now. He may face stiff opposition in the both the Senate committee and the Senate as a whole, because he's been fairly blunt about his anti-employee type enactments. But I think ultimately he will be confirmed, and I do think that it will be a quite different Department of Labor under Puzder than it was under Tom Perez, who, interestingly, by the way, I saw last night on the news on MSNBC, and he was very blunt in his criticism of the incoming Department of Labor Secretary. Not certainly a surprise, but very, very blunt in his criticism of the guy who hasn't even gotten a hearing yet before the Senate subcommittee. So we'll see what happens, but the freezing of pending regulations, I think, is not unexpected, and it may roll back many of the kinds of regulations that we've talked about in 2016, including the persuader rule, which I think is all but dead under a Trump administration. Okay, couple cases that I wanted to mention that very, very recent. So one case came out, this is a Tenth Circuit case, just decided last week. It's a case called DeWitt versus Southwestern Bell Telephone Company. It's a Tenth Circuit case, and here we had the termination of a customer service representative who happened to have type 1 diabetes. And she was on an already a last chance agreement with Southwestern Bell Telephone Company, and what happened was she hung up on two customers on two separate occasions in during a shift, which precipitated her termination. She then filed a lawsuit against Southwestern Bell Telephone Company under claims of ADA and FMLA violations, saying that she had been discriminated against on the basis of her disability and on the basis that she should have been provided with FMLA leave for her problem, because she indicated that the reason that she may have hung up on customers was because she was having a diabetes-related incident while at work. The trial court granted summary judgment to Southwestern Bell Telephone, and she appealed to the Tenth Circuit. Tenth Circuit, interestingly, reiterated that the concept in employment law is that when an employer makes a good faith, honest decision that an employee is engaged in misconduct, that that good faith, honest decision will overcome any claim of discrimination or retaliation, or a claim that there should have been a different outcome, or that somebody looking at it from the outside would have come to a different conclusion or imposed a different penalty or discipline on the plaintiff. Essentially, what the Tenth Circuit said is that even if you have a disability as an employee, it does not excuse misconduct in the workplace, and that an employer's assessment of misconduct, as long as it's reasonably based, judged on what an employer viewed as facts at the time of the discipline, is not going to be second-guessed by either a trial court or an appellate court. And this is not a unique finding, although it's certainly just a week old. Many circuit courts say the same thing, and I know that I've counseled clients many times on the fact that when they are considering the discipline, and particularly the termination of an employee based on an assessment of facts, that it is the good faith judgment of the employer that really is important. And as long as that good faith and honest belief is supported by facts as they see them at the time the action is contemplated and taken, that no court, either trial court or an appellate court, is going to second-guess that employer. That doesn't mean that there's not some risk to the employer, but it does mean that the good faith and honest belief of an employer is often credited, and there is a high bar for an employee in a discrimination case to basically defeat that honest claim and good faith belief of an employer who has made a judgment that discipline is warranted, particularly in a termination case. So it's a good statement of that, again, only a week old. Another case that I wanted to just briefly mention is a Ninth Circuit case decided last Friday involving Schlumberger, and it's a Fair Credit Reporting Act case. And it's it restates a concept which is not unique, but nevertheless is one that needs to be, I think, circulated and known by employers, because what happened in this case is that Schlumberger, on its application form, combined the Fair Credit Reporting Act disclosure and contained a statement which, and I quote, "I hereby discharge, release, and indemnify prospective employer from all liability and claims arising by reason of the use of this information that is false and untrue if obtained by a third party without verification." Those of you out there who obtain information through the Fair Credit Reporting Act on applicants or even employees have to know that under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, you need a separate disclosure form for the applicant or employee. And that separate disclosure form can't contain a waiver of liability or any other kind of content. It is solely to disclose to the applicant or employee the fact that you as an employer or prospective employer intend to get consumer information in the form of criminal background check or references, etc., and that there should be no other references to information, for instance, waivers of liability, indemnification, etc., because if you do, you have violated the provisions of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which indicate that you are limited in that disclosure to only indicating to the applicant or employee that you're going to get information and that you get the employee's signature on the authorization to disclose or get disclosed to you information from what's called a consumer protection agency under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And in this case, the Ninth Circuit indicated that they would okay a class action against Schlumberger for having violated it. And of course, you don't intend to do that. I know that there's no intent on the part of Schlumberger or any other prospective employer to do that. But the Fair Credit Reporting Act has come under scrutiny increasingly in the past, and for those employers that utilize these disclosure forms, it should not be on your application form. It should be a separate disclosure form, and if you need any assistance on that, certainly I can help you with that. But you don't want to risk the kinds of liability that are out there for having violated this, because you're also liable for attorney's fees in these cases, which can be substantial. Okay, those are the developments of the day. Michelle, can you take this off of mute? All right, so as always, I indicate that if anybody's got any questions or comments, feel free to raise them in this forum, or if you prefer in private. My email address is hkerman@offitkerman.com, or my phone number is 410-209-6417. Any questions, comments? Okay. Well, as always, there's plenty of stuff, I'm sure, that will come up in the next 2 weeks, and the next telebrief will be on Wednesday, February the 8th, the second Wednesday in February. So keep in touch with what's going on in the Trump administration. There's bound to be a lot that's going to go on in the labor and employment field in the next weeks and months. So stay tuned, and we'll see you again on February the 8th. Thank you.
Thanks, Howard.
Thank you, Howard.
Bye.
Thank you.